Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. On the show tonight.
And we're going to make it clear about a real and present threat situation.
There could be a compromise on Illinois' controversial criminal justice law. A live report from Springfield.
When the vote closed, the feeling on the floor was jubilation and relief.
The Senate passes the Respect for Marriage Act, but some say it doesn't go far enough. We examine what's exactly in the bill.
Health officials are sounding the alarm over low measles vaccination rates. What's behind the decline?
More than a billion young people could be at risk of hearing loss, according to a new study. We talk about risk factors and how to protect your ears.
With petitions in and the filing deadline now passed, our Spotlight Politics team breaks down the race for mayor.
One of the state's bat species is now endangered. A look at the reasons why and how you can help.
And Chicago's Dean of Rock and Roll Photographers talks about access, memorable photos, and his first book.
But first, some of today's top stories. The U.S. House votes to stop a rail strike in its tracks. The legislation would force a tentative labor agreement among 10,000 railroad workers and provide employees with a 24% pay increase over 5 years. But a crucial point for workers was left out of this bill, 7 days of paid sick leave. Instead, it was approved in a separate resolution. Peter Kennedy with the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees Division says he's disappointed Congress intervened.
If they can pass a bill to put us back to work, then they can also pass a bill that makes sure that we have basic protections when we need it most and when we're most vulnerable.
Both resolutions now head to the Senate, where they face an uncertain fate.
Mayoral candidate Jesus Chuy Garcia receives a big labor endorsement. The International Union of Operating Engineers, Local 150, says in a statement that Garcia is, quote, the right leader to move Chicago forward. The union represents 23,000 workers in construction and related industries across Illinois, Indiana, and Iowa. This comes as Garcia's opponent, Brandon Johnson, has also racked up support from major labor groups like the Chicago Teachers Union. We'll have more on the race for mayor coming up in tonight's Spotlight Politics.
Lawmakers gather to commemorate former President Barack Obama's campaign announcement at the old state capitol in Springfield. Many remarked today's ceremony felt similar to Obama's in February 2007 due to the cold temperatures, where he spoke to thousands to announce his presidential bid.
When people come to the state capitol and visit this place, they will forever be reminded of the generational change that President Obama started. They will forever be inspired to hope. They will forever be inspired to believe in change that we can all believe in.
18 months later, Obama came back to the old state capitol to announce then U.S. Senator Joe Biden would be his running mate. The plaque includes a quote from the former president that in Springfield he was, quote, reminded of the essential decency of the American people.
And coming up in the program, why some critics are saying the Respect for Marriage Act is flawed.
But first, changes to a controversial criminal justice law. We're live in Springfield right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
With 2 days left on the legislative clock, Democratic legislators in Springfield have come out with changes to the controversial criminal justice law that'll take effect in January. Amanda Venicky joins us now from Springfield. And Amanda, what do these changes do? How far do they go?
Well, Brandis, remember that crime was really a big issue for the elections earlier this month, and front and center of that was the Safety Act, with detractors saying that this law was going to allow dangerous criminals free on the streets, and then defenders saying that the law is an overdue overhaul of a racist system that punishes the poor. Now, even with the election over, the Safety Act remains at the forefront. This is because Illinois is preparing to become the first state in the nation come January 1st, to completely do away with cash bail. About a month, really just several weeks out from that, one of the lead sponsors of the Safety Act is out with a 308-page amendment that is chock full of changes. State Senator Robert Peters, a Democrat from Chicago, had previously said that his party's major wins in Illinois' elections were a referendum that showed residents support the Safety Act as is. Still, he says advocates always knew that it was going to need tweaks and clarifications, and now he is out with a plan to do just that. He says that settling on a language for doing so was difficult given the immense political pressure and also the millions of dollars that were spent on campaign ads attacking the Safety Act. But he says that he is hopeful legislators will back his new plan tomorrow when it is up for debate.
We have, you know, have had serious conversations with people, with stakeholders to get to this point. I believe that this is a really good trailer bill. I believe that this is a really good opportunity for the state of Illinois. And I want to make it very clear, this again puts Illinois at the forefront of pretrial justice.
Amanda, walk us through some of the changes.
Brandis, there are a lot of them. One of critics' major concerns, though, had been under what conditions someone could be kept in jail before trial. Republicans and also dozens of state's attorneys from both parties, actually, had said that the legal standards for determining that were too narrow. Now, Peters' proposal actually expands that list, and it explicitly spells out that someone can be denied pretrial release if they are charged with additional offenses, now including second-degree murder, armed robbery, and kidnapping, arson as well. His plan also says that in order to be denied release, a defendant must be found a real and present threat to the community. Now, that is another change here, and it addresses criticism that the bar for determining whether somebody is a danger had been set too high, because as written now, the law says that a defendant has to be a threat to a specific person. So again, you're moving the standard from somebody having to be a threat to a specific individual to being determined that they could be dangerous to the community at large. Now, critics also had said that as written, someone on electronic monitoring would have to be offline for a full 2 days before law enforcement could do anything about it. And Peter's new proposal strikes that language.
So, Amanda, what about people who are already in jail, including because they can't afford to pay their bond?
Yeah, Brandis, because that had been another subject of controversy with the Republican nominee for governor, Darren Bailey, comparing it to a purge law, saying that come January 1st, all of a sudden criminals would be let loose. Peters says that that was always false, that it was an over-the-top political attack. But his new plan does lay out some specifics for what will happen to those individuals, and particularly what it will happen to those who are in custody when the law takes effect on January 1st. Basically, defendants will be entitled to hearings, and those who likely would not be in jail if they had been arrested in the year 2023 instead of 2022 will get priority for getting their hearing first.
Amanda, what's the early feedback on Peter's new plan?
So again, Brandis, this is a lot of detail. It is dense. It is hundreds of pages long. Legislators have had the day to digest it. But still, this is likely to not be the final plan. We're expecting more changes before it comes for hearings and votes tomorrow. I did, however, get some early feedback from folks, including a Republican legislator who also had previously served as a state's attorney. And he says the fact that there are these changes is vindication, that his concerns, as well as those that others have been expressing for months, were valid. Still, he says these changes do not go far enough for him. And also, he says that GOP lawmakers were not included in these negotiations, and he says their feedback would have made for a better product. You have, however, other stakeholders that are more neutral on this, including those that had not wanted to go this far, that liked the Safety Act and the move to cashless bail pretty much as it is now. For example, you have the Cook County Public Defender's Office taking a neutral stance on the plan. Peters, we asked him whether he expects it's going to have any GOP votes. He couldn't comment on that, but he did say that he believes that many black lawmakers who are crucial to passage of this will be behind it, and he believes that it seems to have the support that it needs to pass. He says that his mission is to be prepared with the Safety Act and for Illinois to eliminate cashless bail come January 1st.
And make sure that no matter what county we are in, whether that's Vermilion County, whether that's Cook County, whether that's DuPage County, whether that's Champaign County, that this law is going to affect and people are practicing and doing it.
He says then Illinois will be on the forefront of things. Again, that law taking effect no matter what. The question, however, is if it will be changed. And we'll learn more about that tomorrow when, again, it is scheduled to come up for a vote in the Senate across the way and in the Illinois House where I'm standing right now. Back to you, Brandis.
Thanks, Amanda. We look forward to hearing more about that when it comes up. Of course, we'll see you later on tonight in Spotlight Politics. Thank you. And now to Paris. And what's exactly in the Bipartisan Respect for Marriage Act? Paris.
Brandis, in a landmark vote, the U.S. Senate passes a bill designed to strengthen federal protections for same-sex and interracial marriages should the Supreme Court strike down protections that currently exist. But some critics say it goes too far, while others say it doesn't go far enough. And joining us to talk about it all are Camilla Taylor, the Director of Constitutional Litigation for Lambda Legal. That's an organization focused on civil rights for the LGBTQ plus community. She also worked on the Obergefell versus Hodges case. And Marcy Bianco, a writer, editor, and cultural critic who wrote an opinion piece for NBC News Think titled Respect for Marriage Act is a Pitiful Band-Aid. We welcome both of you here to Chicago tonight. Camilla Taylor, first with you. Remind viewers what this law does and does not do.
Well, thanks for having me. So we're celebrating today because this law, which is a very narrow law, admittedly, does two things. One, it requires the federal government to respect marriages that are validly entered into by same-sex couples. And it also requires states to respect the marriages entered into in other states. There are a number of states we know will take action immediately to try to prevent same-sex couples from continuing to be able to marry if the Supreme Court were to reverse its decision in Obergefell. And those states would still be forced to recognize the marriages entered into in other states that continue to license same-sex couples.
And just to be clear, so say a couple from North Dakota goes to New York to get married, their marriage will be recognized back in North Dakota when they're filing their returns, and they'll be able to file jointly.
Yes. Congress used its full faith and credit authority to make sure that states are required to respect the marriages entered into in other states.
And Marcy Bianco, does this bill go far enough for you?
Well, I think it does as much as any piece of equality legislation can do. I agree with Camilla. It's very narrow in scope. To me, it's very much an unfortunate necessity of where we are at the moment, at a time when there is a conservative supermajority on the Supreme Court. The former president of the United States had 3 Supreme Court justice appointments. I thought he would get 4, actually. And he had more than 230 judge appointments. So it feels like an unfortunate necessity in terms of almost like a Band-Aid to protect us from bleeding out. But again, I think it goes as far as any piece of equality legislation can go, because equality is an artifice that is applied externally by institutions, law, and policy that does very little to protect and help us and secure us and provide us safety and human dignity on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I think about, you know, how do the Club Q survivors benefit from this act? So that's what kind of framed my thinking going into writing this piece.
Club Q, of course, the club in Colorado Springs where the shooting occurred. Let's listen to what Jim Obergefell had to say about this. Of course, he is the namesake behind the Supreme Court case.
I find it curious that it's called the Respect for Marriage Act, because this act does not respect the LGBTQ plus community, our marriages, our relationships, or our families. And the fact that this act would allow states to once again deny marriage licenses to same-sex couples, where is the respect in that?
Camilla Taylor, Marcy, acknowledge the political realities here. You had to get 10 senators from the Republican side to avoid a filibuster. This was the way to do it. Is there still a threat of discrimination for LGBTQ couples should Obergefell be overturned one day?
There is absolutely an enormous threat of discrimination against LGBTQ couples. And Jim Obergefell is right. This act does not require any state to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples if it doesn't want to do so. And historically, the federal government deferred to states to determine what the requirements were for marriage and who can marry. and Congress didn't do anything that was different or unique from what historically the federal government has been able to do. Instead, it took a very narrow approach, a very, I think, ironclad approach in terms of how robustly it can withstand challenge. And it did what it could in the moment in order to make sure that if the Supreme Court reverses Obergefell, that there will still be some measure of protection, not just for same-sex couples themselves, but for their children who rely on their parents' marriages in order to be understood as a family.
Marcy Bianco, whether this bill is narrow or not, it did get 12 Republicans on board, which 10 years ago, 20 years ago would have been unthinkable. How do you think this evolution happened?
Well, I think in this particular case, how it happened is that it allowed for, or at a late stage, additions were made for protecting religious liberty. I think that's how the 12 Republican senators came on board, is that it codifies, if anything, what it codifies is protections for religious liberty, meaning, you know, code for discrimination against LGBT people. So, yeah, that's how it happened in this context.
Well, I will say there were senators like Rob Portman from Ohio, who himself has a child that is part of the LGBTQ community, who felt that this was the right way to go. But expound on that, Camilla, if you would, some of the religious exemptions in here.
Well, there is some language in the bill that protects religious liberty, but it, to a great extent, simply restates the protections that already exist in the First Amendment for free exercise of religion. So the bill makes clear that no church is going to be forced to marry a same-sex couple if it chooses not to, or it will be forced to allow its facilities to be used for a marriage of a same-sex couple if it doesn't want to do that. These are things that the First Amendment wouldn't allow anyway. So I think it's important language in order to reassure the American public that the law does nothing new with respect to requiring respect for marriages, and it does not infringe religious liberty in any way. I think that made it easier to pass, but I do not think in any way it's going to be used as a weapon in order to limit the civil rights of LGBTQ people going forward.
Marcy Bianco, as we stand now, do you foresee legal challenges that are making their way through the system that could one day threaten Obergefell, given what we know Justice Clarence Thomas has said in the wake of the abortion ruling?
I feel like this is a very difficult question to answer, because the Supreme Court no longer believes in precedent and is very ideologically driven. So, of course, I believe there will be challenges. But at the same time, if we look at data, there are maybe roughly, according to 2019 data, 550,000 same-sex married couples in the United States. But there are more than 23 million LGBT people in America. So who is being served by this act? What does it actually do? To me, my concern as a cultural critic is looking at what it's a symptom of. And again, just looking at the numbers, looking at the difference, I feel like Congress could have done a lot more to work to protecting us as a community.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Camilla Taylor, Marcy Bianco, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And now to Brandis and what's behind low measles vaccination rates. Brandis.
In Paris, officials say not enough children are receiving their first dose of the measles vaccine. New research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows the vaccine rate has reached its lowest number since 2008 at just 81%. That's globally. Here to explain the impact of this decline and how Chicago is doing to fight to eradicate the measles is Chicago's top doctor, Department of Public Health Commissioner, Dr. Allison Arbody. Welcome back, Dr. Arbody.
Thanks for having me.
So what's your first concern when you hear the CDC report that only 81% of children worldwide have received their first measles vaccine?
So measles is one of the most contagious diseases out there. And if people are not vaccinated against measles and there's a single case of measles, it will spread, and it will spread like wildfire. We need about 95% of the population to be vaccinated to really have herd immunity for measles. And so when we hear about numbers dropping down to 81% globally, I'm very worried, because we will see measles outbreaks in other countries. And then when people are traveling to those other countries from the U.S., there's an increasing chance that they'll bring it back to Chicago.
What are some of the factors you think might be related to why it's declined so much?
Yeah, so I think the biggest one is just there's been a lot of disruption in healthcare systems because of COVID around the world. You know, happily here in Chicago, we still are much more vaccinated than that. If you look at kids of school age, still about just under 97% have had those measles vaccines, but even that is down about a percent, you know, from right before COVID. And we've just seen a lot of attention on COVID and being taken away from some of these more standard diseases. I think here at home in the U.S., we've also seen some more just questioning of vaccines in general related to COVID. And if people don't have confidence in vaccines, they may not choose to get their kids vaccinated. I never thought we would be talking in a serious way about measles in this country again, but we are.
In Chicago, as you mentioned, your office identified just two measles cases in 2019, none in the years 2020 or 2021. Illinois saw 9 cases in 2019, also none in the last 2 years. We don't have numbers for 2022 yet, of course. But to what do you attribute those infection rates and, as you said, the high vaccination rate?
That's right. That's exactly what it is. We have very high vaccination rates. And when we have high vaccination rates, we don't have big problems with measles. I worked on a measles outbreak in Cook County back in 2015, measles got into a daycare there, and almost every child under the age of 1 got measles because they were too young to be vaccinated. So everybody getting their vaccines when they should, approximately age 1, approximately age 4, gets us that herd immunity and helps protect the kids who are too young to be vaccinated as well as others. So the reason we haven't had major problems with measles recently in Chicago is because of those excellent vaccine rates, and that's where we want to keep them.
So reports in Ohio, where there's recently an outbreak there, cite this growing moral opposition. And you've kind of mentioned this as well. But are you concerned about misinformation in particular around the COVID vaccine kind of also, you know, kind of happening to other vaccines?
I am. We're starting to see, like I said, in Chicago, just a little bit of a downtick, even in those standard childhood vaccinations. And I'm worried because people may not remember measles, may not remember polio, may not realize that these are diseases that literally kill millions of children around the world, you know, that we've been able to avert through vaccine. This is not an optional thing to decide whether to vaccinate your child, really. It is required for school, for example, and there's very good reason for that. Even a single case of measles, it will spread. It's about 97% likely that it will spread to anybody who is not vaccinated and nearby.
What are some of the myths about the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine?
Yeah, so I think the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, the biggest one probably is there was a study that has been debunked multiple times now that suggested could there be a link with autism and the MMR vaccine. This has been studied every time, you know, every which way since then, thoroughly debunked. In fact, the researcher who put it out has sort of lost his license, et cetera. But I think, you know, people are sometimes reading information or getting information not from their pediatrician. They're getting it off the internet. And I always encourage anybody, we like parents to have questions about vaccines. We expect it. But we want to make sure that you're getting your information from the right source. Your pediatrician is the best source. Every pediatrician is going to strongly recommend getting that measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, because if your child doesn't have it, if they come into contact with somebody with measles, they're almost certainly going to get the measles.
Late last week, Cook County and Chicago shifted back into the medium community level for COVID-19. Now, this time last year, the Omicron variant was just weeks from setting in, and we all know the havoc it wreaked. Today was a cold one. Got us thinking about the winter. What do you think this winter might be like for COVID?
So we don't have a crystal ball to know for sure. At this point, the big question is, will we see another really different and concerning variant like Omicron from last year? We keep seeing the virus mutating, but the good news is it's all been Omicron recently. And the updated fall 2022 COVID booster is designed to help fight off Omicron. So if we can get a lot of folks getting that vaccine this fall, I think it will help protect against the likelihood of a big bad variant this winter. We're certainly going to to see a surge in respiratory viruses, COVID included. Influenza is on the rise. And I do want to just encourage people to get up to date with all of your vaccines. If you're not feeling well, stay home. Put a mask on if you're not feeling well. That helps keep you from spreading germs to others, no matter what virus is affecting you right now. We're going to get through the winter, but I am a little worried about it.
And before we let you go, how are you feeling about the vax rates of the bivalent booster?
I'm concerned. Only about 15% of Chicagoans over the age of 5 have had that fall 2022 booster. It is not where we need to be protected heading into this winter. So if you haven't gotten it, if you haven't had a COVID vaccine since Labor Day, it's time. Everybody over the age of 5, it's really important because we just don't want to have another winter like last year. The vaccine is our best chance to avoid something like that again. I don't want to be talking about COVID for the next few months with you.
I know. Yeah, last winter was ugly. But thank you so much for joining us, as always, Dr. Allison Arbony.
Thank you.
And up next, one of the state's native bat species is now endangered. A look at the reasons behind the new designation right after this. They might be considered a symbol of Halloween and vampires, but there's something frightening happening to one of the state's bat species. The northern long-eared bat has been placed on the endangered species list mainly because of a deadly disease called white nose syndrome. WTTW News reporter Patty Wetley joins us now to explain. So, Patty, the endangered species that we're talking about, northern long-eared bat.
Yes.
Tell us about this bat.
Well, it's one of 13 bats that's native to Illinois. It can be found throughout the state, although it spends its winters in the southern part of the state because that's where all the caves are. So it's a bat that hibernates over the winter, and that actually is part of the problem because that's where the fungus that causes white nose syndrome likes to hang out, in the caves with the bats.
Okay, and what is white nose syndrome?
Well, they discovered it in about 2006, 2007. It's a fungus, and it likes to hang out in these dark, damp places, and it gets on a bat's nose or its wing when it's hibernating. And the upshot is that it causes the bats to wake up from their hibernation, and they wind up expending all of this energy that they really need to be storing up throughout the winter. There's no food for them to find, and, you know, it causes them to, like, lose all their energy, and it's quite deadly for them.
So if a vaccine or treatment doesn't exist, is there anything that the average person can do to help?
Right. Well, being listed helps quite a bit because it does give them some protections, especially for their habitat, the places that they, the trees that they like to roost in. But frankly, the most that we could do as regular members of the public is to learn more about bats and all the benefits that they provide the ecosystem, like eating the insects that could destroy our crops. They like to eat mosquitoes. So apart from just, you know, their existential right to exist, they do a lot for humans, too. And we should know that and, you know, respect them, protect their habitat, give them a chance to survive.
Circle of life. We all have a role to play. The bats, too.
Yes.
All right. Patty Wetley, thank you so much.
Thanks, Brandis.
And you can read Patty's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. And we're back with more right after this.
Coverage of science and technology on Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Joel M. Friedman, president of the Alvin H. Baum Family Fund.
And still to come on Chicago Tonight, a study estimates that more than a billion people worldwide ages 12 to 34 are at risk of developing hearing loss. It's the end of an era, as Alderman Ed Burke says he won't be running for re-election after 5 decades in City Hall. Our Spotlight Politics team assesses his legacy. And Chicago's Dean of Rock and Roll Photographers talks about access, memorable photos, and his first book. But first, some more of today's top stories. Mayor Lori Lightfoot has been hit with an ethics complaint after accepting a $25,000 donation from the owner of the Chicago Fire, Joe Mansueto. The donation comes 57 days after City Council approved a Lightfoot-backed proposal to turn 26 acres of Chicago Housing Authority land to the Chicago Fire Football Club. The complaint was filed by 15th Ward Alderman Raymond Lopez, who is running for his seat again after dropping out of the mayoral race. Lopez tells WTTW News that the appearance of impropriety is, quote, overwhelming. A Lightfoot campaign spokesperson tells WTTW News that the mayor was proud to have the support from Mansueto, whose team did not respond to a request for comment. And there is more on this story on our website. President Joe Biden says he believes legislation to help avert the rail strike should reach his desk by this weekend. This after the U.S. House voted to pass the bill today. It would force a tentative labor agreement among 10,000 railroad workers and provide employees with a 24% pay increase over 5 years. It is one of two resolutions at play, the other being a more controversial one that would provide workers with a much-wanted 7-day paid sick leave.
The president, of course, he supports paid sick leaves for all Americans, including rail workers, but he does not support any bill or amendment that will delay getting this bill to his desk by this Saturday.
Chicago drivers, beware. The city's overnight winter parking ban begins tomorrow. That means cars will be towed from main roads, whether it snows or not. It doesn't come cheap. The minimum towing fee is $150 plus a $60 ticket and a $25 a day storage fee. Parking ban remains in effect between 3 a.m. and 7 a.m. through April 1st. Motorists can call 311 or visit chicagoshovels.org to see if their vehicle was towed. That constant ringing in your ear, it's pretty annoying, isn't it? A new study from BMJ Global Health says as many as 1.35 billion young people across the globe are engaging in listening practices that could make them susceptible to hearing loss. And it's hard to imagine that risk going down with the prevalence of earbuds, loud concerts, and just the general din of city life. And joining us now with advice on how to protect your ears is Dr. Tracy Nguyen, a licensed clinical audiologist at Northwestern University's Center for Audiology, Speech, Language, and Learning. Dr. Nguyen, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right, first of all, this study says as many as 1.35 billion young people are engaging in unsafe listening practices. What does it mean to be engaging in an unsafe listening practice?
In general, it means listening to things too loud. And not protecting your ears. So, like you said, we're exposed to lots of noise in the city, earbud use, public venues, concerts, sporting events, very loud input into the ears. And if you're not protecting your ears, we're all susceptible to that damage.
Is there a specific threshold in terms of decibel level and that amount of time exposed to that decibel level?
Yes, and it is a factor of level and time. So there are guidelines from OSHA and other organizations that outline safe listening levels. The basic rule of thumb to remember is nothing more than 85 decibels. If anything's above that, you want to be limiting your time. But it's a logarithmic scale. So if you can be exposed to 80 decibels for 8 hours safely, but if you go up to 90 decibels, you've got to cut that down to 4 hours and so forth. So there are apps that you can use to measure sound levels, and just keeping that at a safe level is really important.
If you hear ringing in your ear afterward, it's probably a sign
that
maybe you should come down a little bit. So are you surprised at the results of this study that so many young people are engaging in unsafe listening practices?
Yes. I think what it's basically telling us is we're all susceptible. So whether you're young or old, we're all in a very noisy world. So a billion is a lot of people, but that tells me that pretty much everybody is at risk as the world gets louder and louder. I don't think it's not a new problem, but we just have a lot more that we're exposed to these days.
You've got earbuds, as we mentioned, concerts, sporting events, the general din of city life. Do you anticipate more people over the years falling into hearing trouble, tinnitus, as a result of our current culture?
Absolutely. Unless people start paying attention and protecting themselves, if these venues are not going to turn it down and it doesn't seem like they're going to, it's going to be up to the individual to protect themselves. So unless that happens, I definitely think we're going to see more and more noise-induced hearing loss over time.
In terms of protecting yourselves, you've got those foam earplugs you see at Walgreens or CVS. You've got maybe the higher-end specialized earplugs. Mm-hmm. What works the best?
They all work well if you use them properly. So even the little foam ones that you can get at the drugstore, if you put them in your ears correctly and wear them right.
I have one in my pocket
right
now.
There you go. They're perfect. If you can get that down real small and then get it into your ear nice and deep and let that expand. It can provide quite a bit of protection, but you can get custom ear protection that filters sound so that it won't distort the sound of music if that's what you're listening to, but we'll keep it at a safe level.
I'm a musician. I know a lot of musicians. If you are worried about this, what are the risk factors that folks should look out for?
Well, again, the level. So if you can download a sound level meter, even just on your phone, and just watch that level, make sure it doesn't go too high. And then using proper hearing protection, and then minimizing the amount of time based on that level. So you don't want to be exposed for too many hours if it's at a louder level. And if you start to notice things like ringing in your ears when you're done, or if your ears feel like they're kind of plugged up after you leave a concert or after you're finished playing, that means probably some damage has been done. So if you're starting
permanent
to notice
damage?
That,
because a lot of times I'll feel you know that plugged up feeling, but it'll go away in a couple days.
Right, and so usually it's very common to have what's called a temporary threshold shift. So your hearing drops temporarily, maybe for 24 or 48 hours, but recovers. Over time, however, that will stop recovering, or could stop recovering. So you might be fine with one or two exposures, but if you're doing this, you know, on a weekly basis or going to concerts all the time, it's just noise exposure through your lifetime is going to add up and cause damage.
And you're dealing with these patients on a day-to-day basis. How does it impact one's life, their well-being, their happiness?
Yeah. It can be pretty dramatic. I mean, for some people, you know, tinnitus or hearing loss doesn't bother them that much, but for other people it can be pretty devastating. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of up to an individual, but I would say if you can, avoid it, just because you don't want to find out.
Is there a headphone that's better? I mean, everyone's using earbuds right now. Some people like to use the big foam headphones. Is one better than the other?
Not necessarily. Again, it's you want to keep things at a safe level. Certainly with the earbuds, the closer you're getting that sound input to the inner ear or the eardrum, the more likely it is to do some damage. So the over-the-ear earphones tend to be a little bit safer. But if you crank those up loud enough, they can be just as dangerous.
All right, Dr. Tracy Nguyen, a lot of useful advice here for all of us to keep in mind. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And up next, our Spotlight Politics team breaks down the race for Chicago mayor. But first, we take a look at the weather.
Proposed changes to the controversial Safety Act that ends cash bail in Illinois. The field is set for Chicago's mayoral election and the end of an era at City Hall as Alderman Ed Burke, first elected in 1969, says he won't seek re-election. Here with all that and more is our Spotlight Politics team. Amanda Vinicky still in Springfield. She didn't make it back just yet. Heather Sharon and Paris Schutz, welcome back, gang. Amanda, let's start with you there in Springfield. Are the proposed changes to the Safety Act responding to real problems with the act or just misconceptions about what it'll do?
Maybe a little of both. The answer for that, Brandis, really depends on who you talk to. With those who don't want the Safety Act changed much, saying that these are mostly clarifications, that they believe much of the language in the bill as is, or the law as is already pretty clear, but given that there has been so much controversy and pushback, that they are trying to make sure that it is spelled out explicitly so there's less confusion. But then you talk to folks who say, if, for example, I noted a Republican legislator who'd served as a state's attorney who says, hey, wait a second, this is 300 pages of a whole lot of changes, including some of those that we'd been talking about. So while there had perhaps been some over-the-top misinformation that was done for political purposes, there are others who really took this seriously and have heartfelt concerns that they say are at least partially addressed in this legislation, and that proof there is in the legislative pudding.
So, Amanda, will these proposed changes, will this allow Democrats to put the issue to bed finally?
I don't think so, Brandis. First of all, for a couple of reasons, and one of them is that it does not appear as if this is going to be enough to satiate those critics who are so upset about it that they are suing, and that is about 60 state's attorneys from across Illinois, mostly those from the GOP, but not exclusively so, and there is a court hearing for that set on December 15th. There's already an expectation that this is something that could go to the Illinois Supreme Court level, which, after this month's elections, are now going to be fully, even more so, in Democratic control. So we'll have to see what happens there. And again, you talk to critics who say some of these changes are just wrong by spelling out, for example, all of these crimes that are detainable offenses, that there are still more that should be included, or perhaps more discretion given to a judge so that there will be additional changes down the line. You talk to folks like Senator Peters. He says, hey, wait a second. We constantly in Springfield are going back and making changes to the law as it is borne out in real life. So I do think this is going to be a matter of controversy still, but some of the big criticisms are taken care of in this amendment. So those will go away. It will at least quell some as we all watch and see how these changes bear out come 2023.
More to come. So let's pivot to the mayoral race. Heather, Lori Lightfoot made her bid for re-election official on Monday, handing in those signatures, about 40,000 to get her name on the ballot. Now, that's less, though, than Chuy Garcia's campaign, which gathered 48,000 signatures, and Willie Wilson, who's gathered more than 60,000. Is it significant that Lightfoot came in with fewer signatures? Is that unusual for an incumbent?
Yes. So in the past, Rahm Emanuel and Richard M. Daley showed up with 90,000 signatures, an overwhelming show of political force, and that's typically what filing is all about. It's about flexing your political muscle. And Lightfoot has been dogged for months with questions about her strength. If she sought to put those questions to bed with filing, she did not do that. It's going to be a long couple of months.
Yes, it is. So she aims to convince voters that she's, quote, the only rational choice to be reelected. Last time around, she may have benefited from having been an outsider and not having had that political record to run on, but this time she does, and she's ruffled some feathers in the 4 years that she's been in office. Paris, what is her pitch going to be to voters this time around?
Go with the one you know. And maybe all the other ones are crazy. I don't know. I mean, in her mind, I mean, the commercials have been, I didn't get everything perfect, but, you know, I'm the person you know, and I'm working really hard. And by the way, this once-in-a-generation pandemic that I had to manage the city through, we should also mention Paul Vallis today got $100,000 from the COO of Citadel, Ken Griffin's company, maybe a proxy for Ken Griffin here, maybe a sign that Vallis is going to be the consensus business candidate. But Vallis is going to also be connected to the FOP, and he's been dogged by these connections to this Awake Illinois suburban group where he appeared at an event with. So we'll see if it's going to help his campaign war chest. It might not help his perception with all these other progressive candidates in the race.
It feels like we've kind of heard that argument before out of some candidates, out of some incumbents in particular, like, oh, yes, I've made mistakes, you know, but I learned from them and I'm ready to continue in my position and continue leading. Heather, Alderman Ray Lopez recently dropped out of the mayoral race, filed an ethics complaint against Lightfoot for taking money from businessman and Chicago Fire owner Joe Mansueto. What is the alleged wrongdoing here?
So 57 days after the city council changed the zoning on a piece of land on which was once home to the Abla Homes on the near west side, Joe Mansueto gave Mayor Lightfoot $25,000. Typically, companies that do and people that do business with the city are limited to giving candidates no more than $1,500. Alderman Ray Lopez asked Inspector General Deborah Witzberg and the city's Board of Ethics to look into this to see if it violates those limits. Now, I should say we got a late response from Joe Mansueto's office. He said he is proud to support Mayor Lightfoot and he is committed to revitalizing the West Side while keeping the Chicago Fire team in Chicago. It is an interesting quandary to find Mayor Lightfoot in, right? Because in 2019, her campaign pitch was clear and precise. I will bring in the light. I will root out corruption. When she filed on Monday, I asked, what's the elevator pitch this time around? What is the centerpiece of your campaign? And she really just said, we're going to continue what we're doing. Will that work in a crowded field when there has been so much drama and so much pain over the last several years? We will have to wait and see.
So Local 150 endorsing Chuy Garcia. How significant is that to Garcia's campaign, given that he entered the race as late as he did? And that last time when he ran against Rahm Emanuel, he had the support of the CTU. They're now backing Brandon Johnson.
Right. So Brandon Johnson has the support of the Chicago Teachers Union and the SEIU Healthcare and SEIU Local 73. So this was an important announcement for Chuy Garcia to sort of say, look, I've got labor support. But the fact of the matter is that the operating engineers have backed more conservative candidates as recently as the Democratic primary in June, where they backed Kerry Steele over Fritz Kagi for assessor and ruffled a lot of progressive feathers with that. So what you're going to hear from Brandon Johnson's camp, hey, we are still the choice of progressive labor. This is the situation that the progressives in Chicago did not want, right? They did not want this split, and we're going to have to again see how it all plays out.
February. So here is what Garcia said on Monday, though, about his reasons for entering the race.
I am getting into this race because I think I can be a unifying force in Chicago. I think I have the temperament to bring people together. I have the ability to listen to people, to be collaborative and inclusive.
So, Paris, assuming that, you know, with nine candidates, the chances of one of them getting more than 50% of the vote, pretty slim, exactly. So if you're one of nine, or if you're Chuy Garcia, how do you stand out in this field?
I think it's the person that can build on their coalition, that has multiple groups in their coalition. So if you look at Chuy Garcia, he's got progressives, but he's also got a significant chunk of the Latino community. If you look at Paul Vallis, as we mentioned, business and conservative folks on the northwest side and the southwest side, other progressives, they're going to need to build a multi-group coalition. It can't just be one narrow base. The two that can do that will be the ones that get to the runoff.
Okay, so 14th Ward Alderman Ed Burke, who was once the most powerful alderman in city council as chair of the finance committee, says that he is not running for a 15th term. He's, of course, preparing for that federal trial on bribery, extortion, racketeering charges. Paris, how would you assess his legacy?
As someone, you know, you can't really point to big public policy things that he did that really impacted the city of Chicago. His legacy first is as part of the Verdoli Act 29, the opposition bloc to the city's first black mayor, Harold Washington, and then later as chairman of the very powerful finance committee where most legislation went through, but also that committee controlled the massive sprawling workers' compensation system of the city, which meant Burke had a lot of power over what city workers got compensated for their injuries, what city workers didn't. He's known for building massive power for himself through his position and getting massively wealthy through his position. And, oh, yeah, his street was probably the best plowed street in the city of Chicago in the wintertime. But beyond that, he's known as a lover of Chicago history. He's very knowledgeable about Chicago history, which is kind of puzzling that he conducted his public career the way he has in a way that has been more about his power and his wealth and his fiefdom and not about big major policy things that have had a huge impact on the city of Chicago.
Amanda, the Department of Children and Family Services, they've been under a lot of scrutiny over the last year, really, to the extent that the director, Mark Smith, has been found in contempt of court at least a dozen times because of their handling of placement of children. What's the news on that front?
Well, so now you have an appellate court saying that that ruling was wrong, that Smith should not have been found in contempt of court at all. And there is something striking in this ruling. Basically, this was because Smith had not was accused of not doing enough to place children in proper homes that were in the state's care. Instead, they were having to stay in hospitals or in mental institutions long after, for in cases months or even years after they were medically available to be released. And Smith had said that it was too difficult to find places for them to live and to stay. So this court saying that Smith should not have been found in contempt, and that's something that, of course, the agency is celebrating. They had appealed this case saying they didn't want that to happen. But you still have child advocates saying that they believe that this is wrong, that this is going to cause further harm to children. And I want to note in the reading that they say that, yes, it did appear as if DCFS and Smith made efforts to place these children, but it added that it was not done apparently with a lot of urgency.
Okay. So moving on to something else, the fallout from former President Donald Trump's dinner with an avowed anti-Semite and white supremacist Nick Fuentes and Kanye West, also known as Ye. This continues. Without mentioning the former president by name, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell had this to say.
Look, let me just say again, there is simply no room in the Republican Party for anti-Semitism or white supremacy. And that would apply to all of the leaders in the party who will be seeking offices.
Paris, what do you make of McConnell's statement and how Republicans are handling
this? Well, we should mention that Fuentes is originally from the Chicago area. Kanye, of course, is from the Chicago area. But, you know, listening to what McConnell said there, it's kind of having it both ways, because clearly a white supremacist kind of mentality has been a part of the Republican base going back since at least the 60s, going back to John Birch, going back to Nixon's Southern strategy, and evidenced by the fact that right now the guy that wants to be the Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, courts people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who has associated with this man, Nick Fuentes, that we've talked about. So they don't want to say it out loud, but this has been a part of their base. Maybe it's small, maybe it's larger than that. Also, with respect to Mr. Fuentes, a 24-year-old guy, I don't know what's in this guy's heart, but he is part of a group of folks that seek notoriety, seek fame by saying really controversial things, divisive things, and saying that that's some kind of celebration of free speech. So whether you condemn it or whether you love it, he's getting exactly what he wants, which is that fame and that notoriety. Another man at that table, Milo Yiannopoulos, has built his own career on that, and then he fell. So Fuentes, you know, getting a seat at the table, clearly that part of the Republican Party, white supremacist, anti-Semitic, with the former president actually, you know, having dinner with him. So it's hard for Republicans to say there's no place for that in our party. They can say it, but there has been a place.
Apparently, a seat at the table, quite literally. All right, that's Spotlight Politics. Thanks, everybody. Paris Schutz, Heather Sharoon, Amanda Vinicky. And up next, capturing rock and roll and music greats in a new book. That's right after this. Do you think there's been sort of a rethinking of how those events happened here in Chicago?
I made a promise to myself in my career that every year I would make a piece of art dedicated to the memory.
Got into a zone of mentor to children. See what we could do to kind of elevate each other. We all we got at this point.
I'm using my past to push forward, to build a movement, to create the world that we all want to see.
Whether touring with the Rolling Stones or taking photos of Ella Fitzgerald here at WTTW, photographer Paul Natkin has snapped memorable images of music giants. Rock, reggae, jazz, folk, R&B, he's captured it all. And producer Mark Vitale recently captured him, and he shared pictures worth many thousands of words. Here's another look.
When I was starting out, I made this conscious decision from the beginning that I wasn't just going to go and shoot the bands that I liked. If I did that, I'd be shooting pictures of John Prine and Steve Goodman all day long. But I figured I got to be well-rounded, and I've got to shoot everything. So I made friends with the promoters, and I would go to a concert every night. I would go to a thrash metal concert one night, and the next night I'd go and shoot Rodney Dangerfield. These are all my covers.
We met Paul Natkin in his home studio and combed through nearly 50 years of archives. Some work ended up on magazine covers. Other pictures fill the first book dedicated to his photography.
I like to shoot anybody that puts on a show, anybody that jumps around, even if I don't like them as people, which I do like most of the people that I photograph, but I shoot the Rolling Stones anytime they're in town. Buddy Guy, I've worked for over 40 years. I took a picture of Ozzy Osbourne and Randy Rhoads back in 1983. People tell me it's the most famous heavy metal picture ever taken.
That image even ended up on a limited edition snowboard. At WTTW, he worked on the set of Soundstage, where he shot Count Basie and Ella Fitzgerald in 1979. His big break came in 1984 when he photographed Prince, Bruce Springsteen, and the Jackson's Victory Tour in just 1 month. He had incredible access to legendary entertainers.
These guys are not like aliens. They're just normal human beings that just happen to have some kind of talent that propels them to a stage. And they like to have fun, too.
And how many people do you know who can say this?
And I found myself playing pool with Keith Richards against Eric Clapton and David Bowie.
That story's on our website, where Natkin also tells the tale of photographing Prince's birthday party. Even with exceptional access, some pictures are tough to get, including this photo of Miles Davis.
He played the whole show with his back to the audience, and I kneeled on the floor. It was a hardwood floor at Park West. I stayed there for 2.5 hours, until he turned around to leave and he waved and I took one picture.
The music industry has drastically changed in the nearly 50 years he's been on the job.
I don't shoot much anymore. Back 10 years ago, I shot 200 bands in a year. And the year before the pandemic, I shot 8. And it's because bands and managers and publicists don't want to be photographed anymore. They want their friends to take pictures with their iPhones. And they all have the same answer when I ask them why. And they say, because you guys make too much money off of us. And if they ever looked at my sales report from the agency that represent me, they would just start laughing. Because more than half the pictures that they license of mine, my share of the sale is under $2.
And while Natkin celebrates his book release, he's not sure where his archive of music history will end up.
I haven't quite figured that out yet. It'll probably go to a museum or a college. You know, who knows?
For Chicago Tonight, this is Mark Vitale.
The book is called Natkin, The Moment of Truth, and there are more photographs and stories from Paul Natkin on our website, including the time he was shooting pool with the Rolling Stones, like we all do, and photographing Prince on his 26th birthday. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabey family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Wednesday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. You can also get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news.
You can also get the show via podcast in the PBS Video app. And please join us tomorrow night live at 7. Robbins officials are calling for federal help after multiple water breaks in the area. We're live in the south suburb.
And these twin sisters were supposed to be born in Ukraine. How they made it home to Highland Park. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you so much for watching. Stay healthy and warm, and have a great evening.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports free educational initiatives in the legal profession.